grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its fucking house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing, dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, episode 145, Inciting a Black Lives Matter Riot. Today is a roundtable discussion with seven black leaders, spiritual leaders, community leaders, protest organizers, protest participants, folks from all across the United States and even Canada, coming here to discuss what it means to be black in 2020, to witness these protests, to witness this time of societal upheaval and change. It's going to be an uncomfortable conversation for most of us. And I know that I sat in discomfort while having this conversation. And that's good. And that's beautiful. And that's necessary. We all need to get really, really uncomfortable right now so that we can listen better, so that we can be better allies, so that we can understand what kinds of change will actually lead to meeting the needs of black people in this country and people of color at large, but specifically in this time, we are discussing Black Lives Matter and the needs of black people. This is an open conversation amongst black activists and spiritual leaders regarding these protests, police brutality, whether watching things like The Help solves racism, what it means to be a good ally. And we also specifically discuss how white authors, teachers, and publishers inside the pagan community are assisting in the erasure of black pagan voices. So this is going to be an uncomfortable conversation for many. That's good. I hope that you don't hit pause. I hope that you don't stop this. I hope you don't turn it off. I know for me, the intention was to basically turn on the microphone and turn over the microphone. You're going to hear my voice very, very little during this time, as I was mostly there to provide some speaking prompts in between, you know, lulls in conversation. But mostly it is the voices of these leaders that I want you to listen to. Specifically, I want to say a hearty thank you so much from the bottom of my heart to the seven people that agreed to raise their hand and be on this episode, to Kat, Crystal, Lilith, Tiffany, Rebecca, Phoenix, and Amanda. Your bravery today on this episode is unmatched, and I am so honored that you allowed me to witness this discussion. I hope that this helps to jumpstart dialogue in your own community, with your family, with your friends, with your peer group, and with yourself. Because I know that as someone who wants to be an ally, the unlearning and the unpacking of my own internalized racism never, ever, ever stops, because it's so deep in there. And as you know, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed white guy walking around in the United States in 2020, I have a lot of privilege, a lot of it, and so much of it that every time I think I've done the unpacking, there's so much more to unpack and to unlearn and to relearn and to reconstruct. So right now, I invite you to speak little, listen much, tuck in. It's a long episode, but it's worth it. Good morning, and thank you guys so much for being here on Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I am so blessed and humbled that each of you folks, leaders and community activists in your own right, have agreed to join this very important, very timely conversation today. As someone who hopes to be an ally to black people, to people of color everywhere, but specifically to black people in this time of need, it's my honor to be able to turn over my microphone to you all, to have this conversation, to basically use this time to speak about whatever you want, to vent, to laugh, to get angry, yell at me if you want to, that's fine. I'm okay. I can take it. I'm a big guy. But I basically wanted to use Inciting a Riot. I wouldn't be able to call the show Inciting a Riot if I didn't turn the microphone over to the folks who need to incite a riot right now. So with that being said, I'm going to go around and introduce everyone, starting with the person here in my upper left. Kat, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my honor and privilege. Tell folks a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name's Kat Beggard. I live in Niagara Falls, Ontario, Canada. I run a company called Cat and Monkey Events. I also run Niagara Witches and Pagans, which is our local social group. And I also run Black Cat Witchcraft, which is where I teach the locals anything they need to know about witchcraft. Yeah, this is a subject that's very obviously dear to my heart. And stressful and painful and, you know. So that's me in a nutshell. I'm biracial. I'm also in the process of writing a book about being a biracial witch because, you know, I think that it's very important to blend both cultures together and appreciate all the facets of yourself. So, which I think a lot of people have a hard time doing. So that's me.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. Miss Crystal Blanton. Back here on Inciting a Riot, you've been here once before. For folks that haven't gotten that far back in my back catalog, because that was a few years ago, tell folks a little bit about yourself.
Good morning. My name is Crystal Blanton. I am in the Bay Area, California. I am a licensed clinical social worker. I am a pagan. I am a Black woman. I am a mother. I am a wife. I think I've been, you know, doing some form of activism. I don't know, a huge chunk of my adult life. So I think kind of just being Black in the world has, you know, motivated me to do something. And so anyway, it's nice to be here. I think the last thing that I've really truly done in the pagan community around race specifically was being a co-editor of Bringing Race to the Table, the book, and hoping to start some conversations. And so seems like now's the time for us to have even more conversations and more and more and more and more. So I'm really excited to be here.
Well, thank you so much for that. I know you've been a long time, very public advocate and ally here in the pagan community. So thank you so much for showing up this morning. You're our earliest guest on the West Coast. Miss Lilith.
Yeah, it's 7 a.m. here right now.
Well, thanks so much for getting up early. I hope you have some coffee or some tea or the cup of white tea or something to get you going this morning. Miss Lilith Dorsey, no stranger to the show. You were just on a couple weeks ago.
I know. It's so fortunate to be back. Thank you for having me back. And thank you for opening up this platform to the discussion that is so important at this time. I guess I've been involved in the pagan community professionally probably for the last 3 decades. And I've always been an activist and a witch. You know, I mean, thinking back, going out and, you know, protesting this week, I'm like, I think I started protesting when I was probably, you know, too young to walk with my parents. So it's nothing new to me, unfortunately, you know, but it's something that has to be done in every way possible. I'm the author of 3, I think, traditionally published books. I don't know, what day is it? There's a lot of books. I'm trying to be humble about it, but I'm really just confused. I'm from Brooklyn originally, but I just relocated to New Orleans last week. So, you know, it's very busy. We got tropical storms. It's very busy over here in addition to everything else that's going on. So I'm really honored to be here and thank you.
Well, thank you and welcome back. Somebody else that I am very excited to welcome back who had some big love earlier in the year for doing this show. Miss Tiffany Newsom, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. You were here earlier this year talking about homeschooling and specifically, you know, what it's like being a Black mom in Trump's America. So, you know, I'm sad that you have to come back right now. I'm so glad to talk to you. You're a dear friend. I'm glad to talk to you anytime, but I'm so sad that it's been so soon. So good morning, and tell folks a little bit about yourself.
Good morning. I'm Tiffany Newsom. As you heard, I'm a homeschooler to a Black mom of two Black girls and a Black son. I am a wife to a Black cop. I'm a homeschooler. I think I already said that. Let's see, I'm a hoodooist and a conjurer. I am very much into taking into our African-American roots of how we revolutionized what we did as slaves, as early Black Americans, as early Africans, into revolutionizing and using our Orisha, our hoodoo, our juju, and pushing forward, making our way in American culture and American society and fixing it. I teach my kids. We have our altar. I'm not downstairs right now because I just had my daughter's birthday was yesterday, and I have 5 teenagers in the house. I'm not going downstairs. I don't even want to know what my downstairs looks like right now. But that's me. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I remember last time you were on the show, you were downstairs, and then your daughter became a surprise guest at the end.
Yes, yes.
That was so much
fun. And I'm
fun.
Sure she would have so much to say right now.
I'm sure.
No.
Miss Rebecca, good morning. This is our first time meeting. Thank you so much for being here. Tell folks a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you for having me. My name is Rebecca, and I am from the lower downstate area of New York, just outside of Bronx and Westchester. I'm a behavioral therapist and a teacher. I'm also a spiritual coach and one of Lilith's godchildren. So that's how I came to be here as part of this conversation. Although I do have these conversations on a daily basis, because as a teacher, in a very not really super diverse area, I'm one of the few people that can have that conversation. So I'm glad to be here, and thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Phoenix Williams, good morning. Thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Tell folks a little bit about yourself. This is also our first time meeting.
Yes. So my name is Phoenix Coffin Williams. I am currently in Albany, New York. It's my hometown. But I live in Buffalo, New York, right across the river from Cat. I am a licensed clinical mental health counselor. I operate a Wiccan temple in Buffalo, New York. I do a lot of community organization work around working with homeless people mostly, and then also working with women of color and bringing more awareness to the global pandemic of violence against women, specifically women of color. So that is where my passion lies. That is where my work lies. That is what my ministry is built up of. That's kind of how I roll.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I'm loving the diversity of backgrounds and educations and experiences and advocacy and spiritual traditions. We do have, finally, our last member of the morning. Good morning to you, Miss Amanda. How are you?
Good morning. So sorry to be late. I was knitting, watching anime, waiting to join, and I just got way too into it. So I'm Amanda. I am a technical project manager at a neuroscience pharmacogenomic company. I have worked with the YWCA, whose mission is empowering women and eliminating racism. And yesterday I was working with our diversity, equity, and inclusion group on getting our leaders to own up, to be accountable, and was pretty integral a part in getting them to reissue a more specific, forceful mission stating that they stood in solidarity with Black people and Black Meridians. So
that's brilliant. Welcome to Inciting a Riot, Miss Amanda. Okay, folks, we have a full house. Everybody's here. Thank you so much for being here and spending your time here. I'm going to throw out a question to you, and you guys do with it what you will. I had the experience of rolling my eyes so hard they about fell out of my face yesterday when Netflix announced that the number one movie in the world last week was The Help. I love all the faces. the number one in the movie last week was The Help, and it raised a conversation about white savior complexes, white savior characters in films. And it seems right now that a lot of folks are trying to find ways to be allies or to be very performative about declaring their allyship right now. How does this kind of messaging affect you guys? And two, what does being a good ally actually look like? Feel free to speak, whoever.
I mean, I guess for me, and this kind of came up yesterday when I was talking with our leadership team, the ignorance and the cluelessness that comes from the white community when it comes to Black issues is just so, it only comes to the forefront when they are faced with Black issues and they have to deal with them. I did during Black History Month an activity where I asked people to take stock of how influential diversity is in their lives. And for people of color, broad spectrum, a little bit of white, a little bit of Black, a little bit of other people of color. For a large amount of white people, their influence group was all white, and they were shocked. They were stunned. And I'm like, just because you watch media that may have a Black person, that doesn't mean that you know anything about Black issues. And that statement from Netflix saying, oh, a bunch of people, predominantly white, I suppose, watch The Help. Oh, well, bless your heart, baby. If that helps you, then, you know, we all got to start somewhere. That's kind of my thought about it.
No, that is not a place to start. That is not it.
It's not.
I was as a Black woman, and then a Black woman of education, and then a Black woman having still younger kids, the amount of people that come to me and like, how do I educate my children on racism? How do I educate my children on seeing more color? And I'm like, okay, how many Black people do you actually have in your life? Like, you shouldn't be coming to me as a Facebook friend if you don't have anybody in your life that you can talk to. You live in these major cities and you have absolutely no Black friend. And it's like, I don't mind, you know, helping. But at the same time, it's, what are you doing? Like, why are you coming to me? You don't know me from the person on your screen, and you need to talk to me about educating your child on people of color, Black people, specifically Black people, because I have friends who are like in Canada who live near the reservations for their First Nation reservations. So like, yeah, we have plenty of Native American friends, but we don't have any Black friends. And I'm just like, how? Are like, you know, American people here in the major cities, and it's like, you have no Black friends. And the number one movie is The Help. The Help. The Help? As like my grandmother, my great grandmother, she lived in Chicago, and she owned a boarding home. So like other Black people would move in and, you know, live there and go to work and stuff like that. So it's like, when I think of The Help, I'm thinking, okay, like they worked for white people, but my great grandmother worked with Black people, helping other Black people. Like, that just don't sit right.
So for me, the idea of The Help and the white savior complex really kind of gels nicely with the fantasy I have about the evolution of the white man's burden. And so in my head, the white man's burden gave birth to the white savior complex. And like, that's just the generational thing that we have to take a look at, analyze, and develop our own thought forms and images to kind of combat that. I think it's real cute and real sweet that, like, white people want to come in and save black people from the plight. So motherfuckers don't realize, so all you got to do is stop pulling the trigger. That's it.
That's right.
So save that. Save that trigger finger then. I don't know. That's where I'm at on that one.
I mean, I guess for that.
No, I think.
No, go ahead. No. Go ahead. I was just going to say, like, for me, the thing that sticks out is that white people don't police other white people
at all.
So they will watch things like The Help. They'll watch things like Hidden Figures, and that makes them feel safe because they're like, oh, I would never do a racism. Oh man, I'm going to watch this, and then I'm going to watch it and feel good about the racism that I'm never going to do. But they will see people in power doing a racism and go, that's awful. Are you okay? Yesterday, the most powerful moment for me was when my mentee, when I just got finished pouring out my heart, and the leadership was like, okay, we've only got two options. Either we reissue the statement or this gets stuck in bureaucracy hell. And she said, excuse me, but silence is complicity. Like, her telling executives, your silence is complicity, when I felt like I couldn't say that because I've been told that me speaking truth to power could get me fired, but her standing up and using her privilege for that, extremely impactful for me. So you've got a bunch of white people who don't know how to police other white people.
No, I agree. I mean, what I was going to say, I didn't mention it in my introduction, but I did my grad work at NYU in cinema and media studies, you know. So I think the issue specifically with The Help is that there are a lot of people who claim to be white allies who are, as you said, making meaning from these things. And, you know, I struggled as a filmmaker. That's why I'm a writer now, because nobody wanted to watch my films. I even had a black brother go, what's wrong with you? Why are you not successful? And I think that there's definitely this real struggle for all of us in any medium to get the black story out. And Netflix is the platform that everybody's streaming right now. So I think that everybody who wants to do something needs to be more accountable. You know, I'm a parent. I was very careful when my daughters were young, what they were watching. One of my goddaughters, you know, will not let her children watch anything that doesn't have positive black characters. And I think not only the black community needs to be asking these questions, but these white allies need to be asking the questions. What did I put on for my kids? Was it Song of the South or The Help, or was it, you know, Julie Dash or something else like that? That's really going to speak to our experience in a way that's much more, I think, genuine. I mean, like, you turned over your platform. Whose voices are we listening to? You know, whose story is being shoved down our throats so we can, you know, gag it up and it stinks.
And I think that's really the place to sort of start with it. We don't have the stories out there for people to digest. And so we have to figure out what's a better story to start talking about. What do we really share with the general public and with people, and especially in education? Because that's really where it starts. Like what Phoenix was talking about, you know, we have come to this moment where everybody's like, oh, you know, in the past 9 days. No. This has been centuries. Let's go back. Let's go back to a place where you don't even know that in Africa they had mathematicians that can do math in their head that you couldn't even begin to understand. And that all got just washed away. And that somebody came in and they happened to have a gun, trigger finger, and say, we're going to take this and we're going to do something about this. And that we don't teach that. We don't go from that space, right? So I know that everybody sort of cringes when we hear the thing about Help, and I kind of feel like, okay, we're cutting up the chicken. You know, we're just cutting it up real small so you can digest it, but then we need to figure out what's the next place. Where do we go from here? What's the next step past the Help? You know, our kids read the Help in the school I teach in, and part of that helped to open up another conversation, but that's not what's happening now because we're in isolation. But we need to figure out what's the next place. And I think things like this, where we open up that conversation and bring more people in and bring more stories in, talking about Lilith's book, talking about other books, talking about other shows. Like, why was it so revolutionary that Black Panther came out? He's a superhero. like they're intelligent Black people that can like build a whole thing. It was like this whole thing. And it's like, okay, we've had superhero movies forever. What do you mean? It's just, but it was amazing because you got to see these powerful, especially Black women, powerful, beautiful, sexy, amazing, strong women fighting for a cause. And it was like, oh, yeah, that's it.
I mean, a lot of white people allow themselves to live segregated lives because they're uncomfortable with other cultures. Like, I've been told by a person of power that, you know, I should be careful not to use slang. When I was in a room of my team with my peers, she was the outsider. And she was, and immediately after telling me that I shouldn't use slang, immediately used white people slang. And it didn't even like cross her mind. It's because she doesn't understand my language. She doesn't understand how Black people speak. Like, she doesn't understand code switching. Like, if I asked her what code switching was, she wouldn't know what it was. And so she thinks that when I am comfortable with the people around me, that when I speak with a, you know, Black culture inflection or whatever, that's me putting on airs. No, that's me being comfortable with my friends and my peers and stuff. But she's a person who would be in a room full of people talking like that and feel like, oh, this is not where I'm supposed to be. And that's not the right way to think about it. I've had, you know, close friends where I'm like, oh, you should really watch this show, Blackish. I think you would like it. And he's like, oh, I don't think I can watch it. It's not for me. And I'm like, do you know how many white shows that I have to watch and consume for entertainment for you to say, oh, but that show is predominantly Black. I can't consume it. It's not supposed to be something I consume. So they allow themselves to have a narrative where there are things that are for Black people. And what they don't realize is that it's for people, and the people just happen to be predominantly Black of another culture, but they're American, or they're, you know, American tangential, that it's okay for you to consume it. And now they're all rushing to consume some media that has Black people in it because they've allowed themselves to ignore it.
I just think about the help and the fact that that is the movie and the top movie right now, and how predictable that is, right? Like, it's the comfortable narrative that white people fall into, where they're still in power, or the representation of power is still in their favor, and so they can watch that movie, versus plenty of the other movies that are out there that are Black stories and Black faces and, you know, The Help. It's just so predictable to me. And, you know, it's just, it really speaks to this issue of comfort in whiteness, right? Where they, you know, challenging the narrative then becomes so uncomfortable that they choose not to. And they have a choice where the rest of us don't. But they choose not to. So then they watch something that just fits into that, and they can, you know, feel like they have done something, or feel like they have, you know, they're educating themselves in a way that still is supporting this narrative of harm. It's just so typical.
That's been sort of my least favorite part of this whole conversation, is when people start saying, oh, I can't take this. There's too much negativity. Welcome to being us. Right. Welcome. We do this every day, all day long, constantly, from the movies that we watch, to TV, to food, to commercials. Like when Cheerios had a biracial couple, a biracial child with a mixed couple, and everybody's freaked out. No, you don't get to take a break. Too bad.
No, that's my life for the last couple of days. I'm just completely and utterly drained at trying to explain to people that are on my friends list that I know quite well, who I recently just posted pictures of the rally that we were at, and my caption was Black Lives Matter. Oh, my Lord. So I then had to explain to people who I thought were intelligent enough to be able to understand that that is a focus, not an exclusion. But they don't seem to grasp somehow that it's not about we hate you because you're white. It's about we're concentrating on us right now. And as people who are non-racist, you should be trying to help and trying to understand. What I find is most white people, when you're trying to speak to them about that, they don't really listen. They only want to respond. They don't really want to hear what you're saying. They just want to respond with the same rhetoric that they always respond with, which is my biggest problem. And it's very frustrating because I don't understand that. Like, if you're not going to listen to what people have to say to possibly maybe enlighten yourself slightly, where are you going in life? I mean, you're just going to have the same horrible narrative you've always had and stick with the same horrible stuff. It's draining. It's very draining. I'm tired.
I feel like white people have used getting into the minutia as a defense mechanism, which is, oh, it's all lives matter. You know, let's just look at this one particular instance. Like, there's nothing systemic, because if it's systemic, then they have to sit back and realize, well, where do I fit in this system? Oh, I'm complicit in it. Like, they want to defend themselves about against being active participants, but when they realize that being complicit is being an active participant, oh, it feels real gross to them. Right. And they don't look, I'm not here to be your therapist. I don't know where you can go find the peace that you need about that, but they don't know how to find peace with that. They don't know. There's no narrative to say you have been complicit in a system that has harmed other people who you do like, who you have neutral to positive feelings over, and you have been part of the problem. And they feel bad about that. And I'm sorry that you feel bad about that, but there's nothing that I can do.
I don't feel sorry.
There's nothing that, well, I try to express compassion because I am not a person who can, like, be angry all the time. Right. It's exhausting for me to be angry all the time.
And there's a subtle difference between being angry and no longer finding space within yourself to hold your sorrow for them. They don't feel sorrow for you on a 24-hour basis. Why should we feel sorrow for them on a 24-hour basis? I don't have that empathy in me to carry that. I don't
either when it comes to others, but there's quite, like, living in Canada, my situation is very different from what you guys have to endure. And let me just say, I'm so sorry. I do not know. Your country is just one big fucking mess. And that, oh God, don't even get me started. I'm so sorry for all the stuff you have to endure.
Country now. This is, listen. Where I grew up, no neighbor would ever talk about my household like that. That's how
It's horrible. I'm like, I feel so bad that you guys, like, racism over here, it exists 100%, but it does not exist on the scale that you guys have to endure on a daily basis for everything you guys do. It's not to say that I don't come across it. I do, most definitely, all the time in the most unsuspecting places. But it's not exactly the same thing. You guys have way, that's just, my heart.
Yeah, bleeds. And people have said it. Racism is so American that when you say that's racist, that's, you know, we're fighting against this, they say, oh, you're not American.
Right.
No. Oh, I just don't want you to shoot me because I'm driving. Like, no, that's American. Eating a hot dog is American. Having a barbecue is American. Being racist should not be the foundation, but it is the foundation that we've been built on. That's another part of it. Like, we don't even comprehend that, and they're trying to take that out of all of the education, right? Like, Texas is like, oh, we're not going to talk about slavery. What?
Right.
Excuse me? What?
That's one of the debates I got in with a friend of mine who's a very good friend, but made some stupid post about, you know, when you start rioting and looting stores and things like that, then it's no longer about racism. It's just about your selfish needs. And I was like, no, it's about hundreds of years of oppression. And when you boil a tea kettle, eventually it's going to scream so loud in your ears you can't take it anymore. So it's called revolution. And sometimes people, you know, things happen during revolution. That's the only way you see change. And we had this whole long argument. I said, you can't even fathom what
we have to go through, and what especially my Black American brothers and sisters have to go through, because it's a totally different scenario than what you're living up here. It's not the same thing.
I mean, you cannot tell me if there was not a British Target, a British Walmart, a British Costco, that the Boston Tea Party wouldn't have been not just dumping tea into a harbor, but looting some coats, getting some muskets, right? You know, maybe getting some skins. Okay, people just weren't looting back during the revolution because everybody had to make their own shit. And getting onto a ship is a little bit of an exercise. So they had to plan that out, okay? But if there was like British like shopping malls, Victoria's Secret, you cannot tell me that Mary Sue Crumpet wasn't going to come away with like a case of free bras. Oh, you cannot tell me that.
They had parties in the square where they've tarred and feathered tax collectors. They tarred and feathered. If you think busting down a Victoria's Secret window is worse than tar and feathering somebody in the middle of July in Philadelphia, you need to check yourself.
Right.
They quartered people. Draw and quarter.
Human lives are more important than property.
No, of course.
Thank you.
I'm not calling it rioting and looting. I'm calling it economic redistribution events. That's what we're calling it right now.
I like that. Yes, that's perfect. Perfect.
Because that's what's happening, you know, and right. I don't think that all of this kinds of words that we're getting, it comes with all this other baggage, you know what I mean? And I think that, yes, that thing was going on Netflix, but I also saw that the burn motherfucker burn about the, you know, LA and the stuff that happened there with their economic redistribution events was also climbing up. So things like that made me proud because, again, you know, this point about listen to Black voices, you know, I had that post. I put that as my post on my Facebook author page and it got pulled because it was, you know, I had an exclamation point. So for some reason, listen to Black voices exclamation point is too offensive for that platform. And that's just, you know, again, such a kick in the everything that I am, that it's just the level of how much they don't want to listen to us, how much that our voice is suppressed on every level.
American white people don't want to listen to nobody. They do not know how crazy they look to other white people. When I was going to Australia and I met some Australians on the flight, they said, "We want you to know that Australian police officers aren't like your American ones. You can talk to them if you need something." And I'm like, I don't even know how to process this.
That's a whole thought.
Word. It's like, right. Thank you for telling me that, but I still might not.
Right. Like,
I don't.
Yeah. Well, that's a perfect example of, I had a couple of guests up from Michigan who are, one is part Black, part Asian, and their children and his wife, who is white. And we were driving down by the falls and I got pulled over. And they were all in the back losing it. Like, they're like, oh, my God, we're getting pulled up. And I'm like, it's all right. He's just going to, you know, ask, because I don't have to deal with that. He was a very nice officer who didn't, you know, it was just, he was like, oh, your taillight's out. Tried to help me fix it. And they didn't even want to get out of the car. They were just terrified. And that's when it really sunk into me. Oh, my God, these people are actually terrified that this officer is going to harm them in some way. Right. And it was heartbreaking. That's just, it's awful. Nobody should ever have to feel like that. Like, that's ridiculous.
So I wanted to pop in here. Hi.
Hi.
And throw out one additional topic. Kat, I know that you said that yesterday, you know, you're pretty drained today because yesterday you were at protests. Crystal, the first time you were on Inciting a Riot was Inciting a Privileged Riot, where we did a lot of public unpacking of what it means to have privilege, what it means to have intersectional privilege, where you might have privilege in some areas and not in others. I'd like to discuss with you guys, or have you guys discuss, the notion of privilege. I also want to throw out, I think Amanda might have used the term earlier, but I might have gotten confused about who did, the difference between being non-racist and anti-racist. I'd specifically like to know what that feels like to the Black community as seeing allies again, or seeing anybody that declares themselves as, I'm not a racist. Okay, well, there's a difference between being a non-racist and an anti-racist. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on privilege, on intersectionality, and the difference between the two different types of, I'm not a racist, I'm a good one.
I think a lot of white people don't really have any notion of what the actual idea of white privilege is. They seem to take that as some kind of slight. The only way it can be a slight is if you are ashamed to be white, because you're white, you're born with white privilege. You can do things that people of color will be stopped for, will be harassed for, will have to deal with a problem for. And it's not to say that that's a bad thing, that you're white, but when you are white, you need to stand up and use that privilege in a positive way. If you are an anti-racist, to help the Black community. If you're a non-racist, you're probably just going to be complacent and not say much of anything. That's to me what the difference between an anti-racist is. It's standing up for what you believe in and to actually fight for what's right, as opposed to just being silent and letting stuff happen, but it wasn't you who did it.
Yeah, I really do agree with that. Because in the United States, the whole system is so intrinsically based upon racist ideologies that the whole non-racist thing is this cute little myth that, like, people want to have. If you vote, you are participating in racism. If you pay your taxes, you are participating in racism. If you are watching police drive down the street, you are participating in racism. If you take yourself to work, whether or not you have a white or a Black boss, that money is going to support a racist agenda. It's not possible to be non-racist in the United States, according to me, Phoenix. I don't speak for anybody else but myself on this one. That's how I see it. My anti-racist folks, however, are the ones who are putting me on their podcasts, are the ones who are showing up to protests, are the ones who are throwing bricks, are the ones who are kicking cops, are the ones who are feeding cops, are the ones who are doing all these other real-world tangential things that go beyond just hitting share on a post on Facebook, right? Getting your ass outside and being seen, representing with your body, with your voice, that you do not support the racist agenda is what makes you anti-racist, according to me and me alone.
I totally agree with that, and that's what we saw. I just have to say quickly that the demonstration I was at yesterday, there were thousands of people there. It was a great showing of support. Many anti-racist white people who I know personally, who were marching, and it was peaceful. It was poignant. And that's, I enjoyed the fact that we pulled that off so well in our community. We need to see more of that. And it was a wonderful woman of color who organized her. It was her first organizing of a protest, and she pulled it off. She did such an amazing job. It was absolutely wonderful. So kudos to them.
My thing are not race. I live in Georgia, in Atlanta, Georgia. So there's a lot of us, and then there's a lot of white folks. I have a lot of non-racist friends. So like, it's, you may be non-racist, but you still use microaggressions, or you still are saying, oh, you speak so well. Or, oh, you know, I never would have thought that hair color would have looked good, but you pull it off, as you see my multicolored rainbow hair. I never would have thought that you could educate your children so well. They speak so well. They attend so properly because I'm a homeschooler, and you find out that all I have is high school education. Your daughters dance so well, or things like that. It's, You're not racist, but you sure are using those microaggressions. Are you sure think that, you know, because you are comparing to what you think my assumption of what Black people should be, therefore you're not anti-racist. You're not racist, but you're sure not anti-racist. Like, you're still comfortable using your idea of what anti-racism is versus, like, you know, your daughter's not excelling well here well enough. Here's a reference to a Black dance company that will help you, you know, expand what your daughter needs, because I'm comparing her Black body to a white body and I need to put her in the back. Like, you're not anti-race. You're not anti-racist, but you're not non-racist. You know what I'm saying? Like you have that, you're comfortable in that middle ground. Versus if you're anti-racist, you're paying me for helping you. You're giving me your money, your white money for editing. You're giving me your white money to promote my homeschooling. You're giving me your white dollars, your white page, your white things, so therefore I can help further myself, my children, my people. If you ain't putting your body, your page, your coins, I want big coins. Don't give me no little coins, because if you're only going to pay me $70 when you pay somebody else $140, don't come for me, because then you're still comfortable in giving what you think a Black person should deserve. Black women are the lowest paid on the totem pole. Don't come for me if you ain't giving me no money. Like, I want my coin. If you can't do that, you're still non-racist. You're not anti-racist.
The experience of being white is having the privilege of having the system work for you. And mm-hmm. So for a lot of people, part of that system is you have racist people all around you, but the process is to not directly address them. No. You're supposed to be polite. You just deal with them, and then you get to enough power level where you can then fix it. You never fix the person. You just work within the system. That is the experience that white people think is supposed to happen. Something's wrong. Oh, well, there's got to be a system or an authority figure to fix that issue. So a lot of them are comfortable being non-racist because they don't know how to be anti-racist. They think being non-racist is being anti-racist. They do not have that distinction unless something horrible is happening. And then there's this scrambling of, where are the rules? Where's a sheet? Where's a checklist? Is there a fact somewhere? Can someone give me a listicle? Like, that's not how the real world works. That's how their world works, because that's how they've structured it to work, and they don't understand that's not how it works for people of color. And it boggles their mind that there's this reality where the system, the process, the rules don't work for everybody, and they just don't have the capability to work outside of the frameworks that they've been conditioned to be in.
Totally agree with that. Totally.
One of the things I was going to say is that the pagan community has a lot of non-racist people in it. So I just want to name that. A lot of, you know, really good-hearted people who don't see race, you know. And it's really a struggle to get people to talk about not only racism, period, but privilege and the way that operates even inside of the pagan community. And so I just want to name that and how challenging that is for people of color and Black people specifically to find support and home inside of the pagan community, right? I think for me, I agree with what everyone has said. And I think for me, one of the things that's really important, is that anti-racism is actually it doing something to engage and disrupt the system that is in place. You know, people can be non-racist all day and think great thoughts about Black people, but if you're not doing anything to disrupt the system, then you are just comfortable. You're not actually working to change the system or change the narrative that continues to oppress Black people in this country and everywhere. And so, you know, there's so many non-racist white people that feel comfortable in that spot, feel comfortable in that individualistic place of like, you know, oh, well, I'm not like that. And it doesn't go further than that. But if you're not doing anything to change the system, it doesn't help me. That's nice. It's nice that you don't think that way. And it doesn't really change anything for me. do something. And that is actually being anti-racist. That is actually challenging the systems and changing these processes that are, that it shouldn't be up to solely up to Black people to change. We didn't create it. Right? White people need to get in there and change the shit that they created. But I think, you know, one of the things I keep falling back on is comfort, and how much comfort is such a thread in whiteness, and the culture of whiteness. And that stops many people from being anti-racist. It also stops many people from addressing their privilege, even learning about their privilege, because it then becomes uncomfortable. And you know, since the terms around privilege, or the, you know, more information about what that means has become more and more commonly discussed, there's plenty of information out there for white people to learn how to understand privilege. They just don't, because it's uncomfortable and they don't have to, right? If they were to learn about it and examine it, then maybe they would have to change something. Maybe they would have to be actively anti-racist. And so it's much easier to just stay in that bubble and not do it. And that in and of itself is just a reflection of what privilege means.
I would like to say that addressing privilege is hard, but it's ultimately worth it. And when I gave my talk to our company, I said, we all have privilege. I have intellectual privilege. And that comes out in my day to day where, you know, I've actually had people say, you are so smart, you don't even realize it. Like, it boggles my mind. Like when people are like, hey, you got to meet people where they are. I'm like, aren't I? are I not? And it's like, you know, it's something that I have to struggle with. Like I have to intentionally, with purpose, go into interactions now that I am aware of that privilege and how it can negatively impact other people, and go, okay, Amanda, you're in this moment with these people. Make sure you're meeting them where they're at. And if you make a mistake, that's okay. They know you. They know you might goof, but they also know that you're trying, and that's okay. I will, for the rest of my life, struggle with intellectual privilege, and that's okay, because it's important to me that other people who may not have that same privilege feel that they can come to me, know that I will never condescend them or intentionally hurt them, and that they can also use my privilege when they need something. Privilege is okay. It makes you blind. It does. If someone's not there to constantly remind you that you have this privilege, you forget about it because you are living high on the hog. But when someone reminds you that you have it, just understand that it's a superpower. It's a superpower, and you use it for good. Otherwise, you're a villain. Full stop.
Right.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, I've been doing a racism and privilege open forum at an event that we do in upstate New York. And I remember running into you, Phoenix, after I did it. Like, I think the second time you were like, how did that fucking go? Like, because, you know, Crystal's right. Having these discussions in the pagan witchcraft communities are so difficult because they're so myopic. They're so tunnel vision. You know, I remember going to events 25 years ago, and it was really this kind of moment where you thought you were going to get lynched because there was 500 people there and two of them were Black people, you know, and I'm like, oh, geez, these aren't good odds, you know. So and we got all those things that they say, oh, I don't see color. Oh, you're just Lilith to me. You know, oh, you know, we're all going to miscegenate into nothing anyway. So what does it matter? You know, and it's just, again, I feel like the line from Tommy, hear me, see me. Nobody's seeing us, and we want to be seen and we want to be heard. And like, yes, you know, it's uncomfortable for you to do this, but I've been uncomfortable my whole fucking life, you know? So just like, let's get with the program here. You know, like I can't change that. I can't change that this is what it is. But if you open up and you start to see things differently, then maybe the whole horrible, evil, oppressive system will change. And I won't be able to have to go through this. You know, my daughter's very light skinned. She's got red hair. You know, I mean, but it's funny to me when she'll walk in somewhere, everybody that's black in the room knows that she's black. And she knows she's got that red hair privilege. And I, there were times I used to say, you're my day walker. I'm shoving you in there to see where the racists are. And then you can come back and tell us. So, you know, she's comfortable with that.
Yeah, that guy.
Somebody got to do it, you know. But I think that we got to use whatever we can, and these people got to use whatever they can to help us. And you know, some of us are in a group, you know, and one of said use allies, and one of our friends said, well, I used an ally to get me pizza. So that's I put that in my blog. I had 5 people send me pizza money. I had pizza money from England, and I'm going to keep taking pizza money because I like pizza. And there are days that it's going to be hard and I want to order a damn pizza, and because of the way the system is, maybe I can't afford it. So let's start wherever you can start. And I was so happy that people listened to me and gave me what I needed in that moment, because, you know, it's not like they're going to rewrite all the history books or all of those things. That's going to take time. But sending me pizza money, they could do that right now.
Yeah.
You know, I think that I'm going to step in it for Lilith a little bit. Privilege is when you don't have to fight for your book to be published.
Oh, well, yeah.
Right.
So, but I'm gonna move on from that one and say, you know, privilege is it's one less barrier to the rest of everything else, right? Like, so non-melanated people don't have to worry about their hair when they go for an interview. They don't have to worry about what they sound like on the phone. That's one of my favorite things. Oh, you sound like a white girl. Okay, I don't really know what that means, but okay, I'm going to assume it's because I sound intelligent and that I can speak and I. But
oh, you sound okay. White. Sure. Don't you love that one? Yeah, you sound white. Yeah. That's
you sound great. White. Okay, well, all right. So anyway, you know, privilege is that, right? You don't have to overcome this other thing that somebody looks at you and says, "Oh, that's a barrier to that thing." And I think being anti-racist is, I am so blessed. The littlest love of my life is graduating in 2 weeks. And, you know, he has a very privileged life. He absolutely knows it. And even before any of this sort of popped off, he started to delve into criminal justice and looking at the way the criminal justice system in America is set up to help him and not help people of color, and to actually destroy people of color. And he decided in that moment that he wanted to become a criminal justice lawyer. That's anti-racism. That's anti-racism, to look at something and to see it and go, wait a minute, I can use my privilege. I can use that. I can get into a good college and I can go far and I can walk into those rooms and say, no, I can stop this here. And that to me, he's my hope right now. He is what keeps me from saying I can't do this anymore, is knowing that I have him and some of my others who are going to use that platform to make a difference. A lot of people can't.
So the discussion of privilege on my end has been like exhausting, it's been hilarious, it's been like infuriating. So I do have a lot of white friends who are very anti-racist. And part of their process in knowing me for a long time has been to slowly discover and then tell me what the privilege they found that they have. And so these conversations, now that we are all grown adults and we're living our lives, and like, wow, I have a lot of privilege. They'll list them out to me and I will say to them, oh, like, you find that particular thing helpful for your life, do you? You find that particular thing helpful for your career, do you? And then they go, well, you managed to do all of that while being a black man. And I look at them, because we have like this strength of rapport, I look them right in the face and I go, I know, right? Master race my ass. Like, let's get real. yeah, there's a lot of white privilege out there, but each and every last one of us in this conversation, right, managed to get somewhere without all of that. And so I'm glad that they're all becoming aware of their privilege and they're doing things with it and they're trying to deny it or spend it in the right way. But recognizing that white privilege is a thing is kind of empowering for me at this moment.
I just wanted to add, you know, kind of along the lines of what Lilith was talking about, you know, inside the pagan community, there's been some very tense times, and that I know I have been witness to, and I'm probably sure even more that I haven't. And, you know, when we talk about privilege, I think it's important to name intersectional privilege. And I know that a lot of the places I have gotten to be a part of or witness in the pagan community is, you know, is because of my own privilege, because of my skin privilege, because of my academic privilege. And I think that's one of the things that we don't talk about enough. Is when Black people are in some of these circles, who has more access and who is heard more, and how skin privilege plays a part of that, or academic privilege plays a part of that. I know I've definitely been in that. Myself, especially in, well, everywhere, but especially in the pagan community, where I'll be heard or given a platform where other people are not.
I totally agree with that too, especially skin privilege, being biracial, being light-skinned, being geographically privileged, affords me a lot of privilege in certain circumstances that if I was, say, with one of my dark-skinned cousins, they may not have the same benefits that I am afforded, which is horrible. It's just, I don't understand how people can think the way they think. Being biracial, it's even harder for me because my mother's Scottish, my father's African-American from the deep South. And I embrace both parts of my heritage. I love that I get to have the benefit of both sides, which is I try to use that to fight for what's right for my oppressed side, because a lot of times I find white people listen to white people. They like to listen to white people. They don't want to listen to Black people. And that there's you know, a friend of mine in the pagan community, went through a big ordeal over appropriation when he is one of the most schooled people that I know, a total anti-racist, and fights on a daily basis for the rights of Black people. And I think we need to kind of understand sometimes that we do need white allies, most definitely, because they're more likely to listen to the white dude than they're going to listen to me. And it's based solely on the color of his skin. And so we need to have those people who earnestly know what they're talking about and earnestly fight for our cause and have taken the time to learn about our culture in order to spread a positive message. So I'm all for keeping, you know, the right allies. I have lots of non-racist friends as well, but I do have quite a few anti-racist friends in my life, and I'm very blessed for that. So I you know, that's my point on that.
I do want to pause for a second. I know Phoenix had to leave. This is a big conversation. I know this is a large conversation. I just wanted to take a moment and thank Phoenix Coffin Williams for his advocacy and for speaking up. For folks that are listening at home, his information will be in the show notes to go get more of him and to reach out to him. I did want to take a second and ask the group, what do folks get wrong? Like, let's not even talk about, like, folks like my mom, who's posting All Lives Matter because Jesus died for us all. Ah, Jesus. folks on Facebook, like, let's just say, let's talk to the people who want to get better. Let's talk to the folks. They posted their black square on Tuesday. They gave their $5. They held a sign. You know, they're here, they're doing the stuff. What are those folks getting wrong? Let's start with the folks who consider themselves allies. What am I getting wrong? You know, I know lovingly and with great care and a subtle knife, at least four of you have called me out personally and quite publicly at different times. So I thank you for that. And I'm privileged and honored to continue to unpack and unlearn my own privilege. So what do folks like me continue to get wrong that you guys see and that keeps you scratching your head or deleting the Facebook app or whatever?
I mean, I don't know. I don't necessarily think you've done anything wrong that I can remember in recent memory, but I know there are a lot of other allies that have not, in my opinion, turned the microphone, the blog, the whatever the hell it is, over to Black voices and have still continued to try and prioritize their own white ally voice, which to me seems like condescending and lost. I mean, I may not agree with some of you here, but at least I genuinely can validate your opinion as part of the Black experience. Whereas if I have an ally going, this is the way to protest, or this is the way to do this, or, you know, and I think also accountability. I had so many white guilt calls this week about, I sell hoodoo herbs, I'm not really bad, you know, I'm a white person, I, you know, but all lives matter, you know, and it's just, no, that is wrong. Like, again, silence is complicit, silence is going to kill even more of us than have already been killed. So ask us what we need, ask us what we want, allow us to say that and amplify that as opposed to your own voice. I'm so tired of watching, you know, all my white ally friends rise up in sales numbers and blog views and YouTube video views while I watch mine sit there like, where am I? Am I invisible? You know, like, because that's just so hard for me to accept. It's even, I am angry, you know, let's get that out. And I am tired. And just seeing it happen over and over again for the, you know, whatever decades I've been on this earth is just oppressive. So that's where I am with that.
Speaking of white hoodooists, the fact that you're a white hoodooist in the first place, oh, the privilege, oh, the inappropriateness. Like, whose ancestors are you calling on? But that's a whole nother issue. Okay. Like, for just, if you're an ally and you're a white hoodooist and you feel that that is your place, not biracial hoodooist, but an actual white hoodooist, and you feel that you're comfortable enough to say that this is who you are and you are okay being a hoodooist, knowing what hoodoo is, and you are not directing them to the infinite amounts of Black hoodooists, if you are not directing people to the infinite amount of Black writers, Black blogs, Black stores, why are you in hoodoo? There was a call to action on Twitter by one of my my people that I love watching. It's a Jujube. And she called for all the white hoodooists to give up the St. John's route, John the Conqueror route, because John the Conqueror was literally for and is for Black people conquering oppression, Black people conquering over slavery, Black people, like, that's what the whole point of the route is for. And there were so many white hoodooists, white witches, white pagans who were like, no, we're not going to give up the the John the Conqueror route because my sales, because this. Okay, did you possibly think that if you decided, okay, if I'm going to be an ally, then therefore you're like, why do you feel like you need to be in a place of reciprocation if you do something? Like, I think that's one of the biggest misnomers, is that white allies don't know how to just completely take it themselves out of it. They always feel like, okay, if I do something, I need to see a reciprocation later on. Even if they're like, okay, I'm facilitating or I gave money, I still need to put my name on it. I still need to do something other than to run across. And it's just like, why are you here? What is your point in being here? If you can say, oh, I did this, this, and this, okay, but where is the direction towards the Black people? Where is the direction towards anything, especially the ones who are raising Black sons or who their sons are light-skinned enough to be able to pass? What are you doing to help make sure that your white passing son or your white passing child is actually helping anything? Like, you can't say that you're anti-racist, but your son, you're like, oh yeah, well, you know, my son, he's light skinned enough, so it's okay. Like, what are you even here for?
I feel like what allies get wrong is when they can pick a fight. Like, you got to fight every day. You don't wait for the opportune moment where you feel like everything's going to turn out okay. You have to pick every fight that comes across your doorstep. Now, that's not to say that you just kind of go about it in a completely ignorant way. But for example, I talked to a non-racist and I said, hey, I noticed that, you know, we don't have enough diversity. And it's like, oh, well, we try to hire diversity. You try. No, you got to do. And then, you know, I took the same thing to someone else and they were like, this is going to be a focus for us. Like, the fight came to the doorstep and one person kind of punted on it, you know, and I could tell the mental calculus in their heads were, well, what if this doesn't, or what if we really need, et cetera, et cetera. Like, they were doing a bunch of calculus for themselves. And they would say that they're anti-racist, but the fact that they had the fact that they could take time to do the calculation of what's the most opportune time was wrong. But I think, but that's the safety, that's the comfort that keeps coming up here, which is, I don't want to rock the boat because the boat is sailing smoothly for me. And that is what every ally who is not actively fighting gets wrong. Because they're, for whatever reason, too afraid to mess up their comfort. Now, I understand. I actually had someone say, you know what? I have a family. I have my kids. And if something really, really bad was going down, I have to admit, I wouldn't come out in force. And I was like, thank you. That's okay. I need to know that information. And I appreciate you for being honest with yourself and honest with me to say that if things are really hitting the fan, don't come to you. That means that I don't get to put you in an uncomfortable position and you don't get to put me in a dangerous one.
Right.
So sometimes allies have to realize when they just don't have the gumption to put up or shut up.
Definitely.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, one of the things that we see too often is white allies stepping in to these conversations and into these spaces and speaking over or taking the space from the Black people or the other people of color that are there. I also see, like, when they're even actively trying to be co-conspirators with Black people or with other people of color, that they are not checking in with the people of color before moving forward, right? Knowing that as the consequences come forward, they're disproportionately going to hit us before they hit them. So if you're in this space with me, you need to be like, I'm about to, we good, right? Like, there needs to be some level of connection around
right.
that instead of just, exactly, right? And so I think that's one of the, even with many people that, you know, I clearly know are, you know, anti-racist in their actions and everything, that one step gets missed a lot of times of making sure that the people of color or the Black people in that space will be safe, or they're given the go-ahead to move forward. One of the other things I would say is for white allies, do your own work. Like, please do your own work. Like, it's nice that you love Black people. That's cool. Me too. But do your own work. Pick up a book. Go out there and read stuff from Black people. Go out there and do, right? Like, you know, I think there is this, I mean, we all know it. There's this default. It's comfort, right? Of going to the Black person you know. Right. And saying, you know, hey, can we have this conversation? Can we do this? And I'm like, well, have you read the book? Have you done this? Well, what have you researched? Well, maybe you should do some research on that. Maybe you should check stats. Maybe you should not rely on what you think. Right. Don't.
And
rely
also
on me.
Too, don't don't come to me for your therapy. Like, if you read something and it upsets you, be upset in your own space. Do not come to me being like, I never realized this touched me. And I'm just going to look at you like, what you
right. want. I'm not your therapist. I'm not your country. I'm not here for your white tears. Don't use me. I'm not your token friend. I'm not the one that you should be like, oh my gosh, I didn't know. Don't do that. Don't.
Yeah, I had somebody do that to me on Facebook. Like, they tagged me in a post of their come to Jesus moment that, you know, Black Lives Matter is important instead of All Lives Matter. And I was like, I'm not even dealing with this. I'm not even responding to you because I'm tired and I'm not doing your emotional labor and I'm not giving you the black pass card. Like, oh, you came to it? Here you go. You get to come. No.
Please go to Arabic. If you have a come to Jesus moment, please go to Arabic Jesus and y'all can have a whole thing together. Do not come to black me because of your moment, because I cannot help you.
But like, you've now finally figured it out that what I've been saying for years and years about your privilege is real. I know that. You don't have to tag me so that everybody else can be like, oh, look, she has a black friend. No.
Right. Or then now I get your friend request. I get their friend request to my to me because, oh, she seems like one of the good blacks. So I can befriend her and she'll educate me. Why are you in my friend request? Get away from me. Get out my DMs. Get off my Instagram page. The only thing you want to come for me for is for education. I'm not the one. Do your own research. Spend my coins. Give me my money.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing, too, is that, you know, we become the comfortable black friend. I don't want to be your comfortable black friend. I want to lean on because you feel like you can use me in that way. No, thank you. No, thank you. I'm tired. I need to lean because I've been doing this for generations. And I come from a mixed background. I had to go through and deal a lot of things with my ancestry. And look at things and mind things, and it's not all pretty and beautiful, and that's okay because it's what made me, and I'm proud of all of them, even for some of the crazy things that happened. But I have to do my own work, so do you. And coming to me to be your comfortable black friend, well, thank you.
But I would also say too, is if you are a white person and you educate yourself and you are uncomfortable, you try to process it yourself, you process it however you're going to process it, like introspectively, and then you still like don't know how to go about increasing your diversity, I think I would be comfortable if someone came to me and be like, look, this is tearing me apart, that I've recognized that my privilege has allowed me to be isolated from diverse groups of people. I don't even know where to start. I really want to start, but is it appropriate for me to do this? Is it appropriate for me to just go downtown and, you know, like maybe go to a black restaurant and start introducing myself? Like, that's the other thing, too, is like we have the privilege. I don't even know if it's a privilege. The reality is that we have to live knowing how to interact with diverse people. And so it's not even something that we have to think about. Like, if it's a Hispanic person, I just say, hi, how are you doing? If it's a white person, hi, how are you doing? Like, there's no expectation for me to be the other in places where there's people of color. But if it's a white person who's coming in trying to increase their diversity and they live, like, my county is 88% white. If they ask me, how do I increase my diversity? I don't know what to tell them. So I can honestly, like, so I understand that there might be people who actually do the work who, my mom's calling, so I'm going to make my boyfriend answer. I understand that there's white people who might need assistance breaking down their privilege, and I don't know what their resources should be. And I honestly haven't researched it because it's not my problem.
In that stance, I don't feel like it's my problem either. Like, okay, if you live in a 80%, 90%, 100% city, town, place, okay, there's other things you can do. What books do you have at home? What media are you consuming? What are you doing that can counteract that? If you are raising a whole bunch of white children, what are you letting them play with black dolls? Are you using your efforts to actually, like, include other color into your home? outside of, I just don't know how to make a Black friend. Like, okay, you can't make a Black friend. So do you have a majority of Black people on your Facebook? What does your timeline look like? What does your feed look like? Like, there's more ways to me than just coming to me and saying, I can't make a Black friend, or I feel uncomfortable going into a place of color because, you know, I don't want to invade into a Black space. Okay, you don't have to invade into my Black space, but you can spend Black coin there. You could be like, okay, I don't want to go inside this business because I don't want to make them feel uncomfortable, but you sure can't order from there, or you can recommend that your friends order from there. To me, like saying, well, you know, I feel uncomfortable going into this space, that's all they've ever known, is going into our spaces and being unwelcome. So at this point, I don't want to hear about, oh, I feel uncomfortable, you know, saying hi to somebody. Like, who cares? You've probably taken their land. You've probably already interrupted their life in some other way aside from you, you know, trying to make a friendship. So therefore, spend your money. Put yourself, put your household into a way that you can benefit from it. Like, to me, that's just a bullshit excuse.
We seem to have a lull in the conversation, so I'll jump in here. I'd like to know from everyone, and you all have sort of touched on this, but I'd like to spend some time in the space of being told the proper way to protest. We have seen a lot of folks, people that consider themselves allies, all sorts of stripes, all sorts of intersections, saying, yes, George Floyd shouldn't have had a knee on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. But, and then of course, everything after the but is just a lot of, you know, how dare you feel this kind of angry or something or other. I love the post where it quoted a Carrie Underwood lyric, and it said, if you've ever sung Carrie Underwood from your full chest, I dug my key into the side of that little pretty little souped up four-wheel drive, then you understand that sometimes you're so angry that things need to break. But I want to know what it feels like, because I know that, you know, the LGBT community is sort of going through some unpacking of its own in the last few days. You know, a big hero of many, J.K. Rowling, has come out as virulently, virulently transphobic, just horribly, horribly transphobic. And a lot of straight people or cisgender gays or something like that are trying to tell folks how to feel, how to protest, how to be angry about that, how to feel and process that. So I'd like to know from you guys what it feels like to be told what a protest should look like, whether or not a protest is or isn't effective, depending on whatever methods are used. I love what Lilith said earlier today about these aren't riots. They're economic redistribution events. I love that. I want that on a t-shirt. So what does that feel like? I'll turn that over to you. And since Lilith, I mentioned your name, I'll kick the football over to you.
Oh, okay. I couldn't unmute myself fast enough. I just wanted to say something about spending the coins. My priestess Miriam likes to say, if you come by, come to buy. So, like, that's how it is. That's the bottom line right there. But to me, these kinds of people telling me what to do, it feels like infantilization. It feels like secondary victimization. You know what I mean? I feel like we're already down. And then these people that are supposed to be our allies are telling us how to act, how to behave, how to conduct ourselves, you know, and it doesn't matter to me anymore that this is coming, at least in their mind, from a good place, because to me, it feels hurtful. It feels, again, that I'm not being seen, I'm not being heard, I'm not being allowed to act in the space that I need, the way I need to act. And you're not me, you don't know what I need to do, you know what I mean? And that's, you know, if your help, quote unquote, was going to work for me, it would have worked a whole hell of a lot long time ago. So allow me to be who I am and do what I need to do right now. Because, again, we all know people don't learn from telling anyway. People learn from doing. So if I tried to teach my children or my godchildren or anything, something, you know, I'm showing them how I am and maybe modeling that this might be an option for them. I don't tell them, you know,
Becca, you know, I don't tell you do this. I tell you this was how I was in the situation. And when they say those things, it never even seems to come like that. It seems to come like this is what you should do. And I've heard that crap enough. I'm just so tired of it.
Look, I hear a bunch of old white dudes talking about, you know, back in my day, if there was a bully, you just fought him. All right, then, bully, I'm going to fight you. I'm sorry, what's wrong? What, you didn't think you were the bully? No bully thinks that they're the bully. You're the bully, and now you're getting fought. You have picked on a group of people enough that we're going to revolt. Like, I had someone say, well, you know, it doesn't help. And I'm like, if that were true, then I wouldn't read in my history books how the Boston Tea Party was effective, how guerrilla war tactics against the Redcoats was the right thing to do, that the Civil War, all the protests and things like that, and the people that died wasn't the right thing to do. Right now, I'm living – the black people in America are living Americans. Guess what? Y'all the British. What? You think you're not saying the exact same stuff the British loyalists weren't saying? You on the wrong side of history.
For me, I honestly don't have enough white people saying anything about writing, probably because they're scared that I'm going to say something because I pop up real quick. I got these hands and I got the time. So I honestly haven't had enough white people on any of my timelines to criticize and say how black people should act. I've had plenty of other black people telling our black people how we shouldn't be rioting or we shouldn't do this because what is the purpose of that? And, you know, not every black person was for freedom. Not every black person was for the end of slavery. Not every black person was for, you know, civil rights movement. There was a lot of black people that weren't comfortable. And guess what, baby? We in for this ride now. All kinfolk ain't skinfolk, but guess what, boo-boo? You're going to get treated the same way I've been treated, and you're going to have to deal with it. You can't write yourself, talk yourself out of this, rename yourself over it. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't bleach your skin out of it. At the end of the day, you're a black person. You're going to come along with me. But I've seen so many black people who have condemned rioting because, like, my dad, he's from Chicago, so he was old enough to remember when the Chicago riots happened after MLK died. What is that, 68, something like that? So he was like 5-6 years old. So, like, as he was growing up, all he saw was the damages that was done to Chicago and how the city wasn't helping clean up anything because black people destroyed it. And my first thing is, that isn't that kind of the point? Is that the city wasn't helping do anything for the black people's anger, like kind of proving my point here that your black people were angry about white people assassinating, and the white people were like, well, y'all tore up y'all shit, so yeah, we're not gonna help you. Who are you really angry at? Are you angry at the rioters? Are you angry at the city and the white people that were in power that wasn't doing anything to quell the anger? Because it's only like you're misplacing the anger and trying to victimize and blame other black people for being angry. Like, no. So now he's talking on this generation how, oh, well, you know, I go up with these old white people and I just ignore when somebody's a Trump supporter, or I just do this and the third. And I'm like, okay, well, that's kind of the point. It's been how many generations and you're still swallowing what the white people have to say. So now that it comes in our generation and we're like, our kids supposed to grew up with Trayvon, or our kids supposed to had been working with Breonna. And it's like, nobody's, you know, we're tired and fed up, and now you want to narrate how black people should be angry because for all your 60 some years, all you've done is swallow white people's tears, and now you want to come and tell us what? Like, what generation should we be tired of saying kumbaya? Like, you named me Tiffany because it was easier because of white hiring. But when I named my daughters Nefertiti, oh, I'm not going to call her Nefertiti. I'm going to call her Nini because that's too ethnic for me. I don't care. Like, for me, it's not necessarily always white people. It's a lot of times it's the black people who want to tell us how to protest because it's comfortable for them. It's comfortable for them because they don't have to deal with the privilege. They work in a white, they work in a mostly white environment, or they, you know what I'm saying, they have a lot of white friends because they grew up out the hood. So therefore now they're in the upper middle class echelons and they want to be able to be city and bougie and all these things. And then, you know, just want to be comfortable about it. And it's like, you don't get to be comfortable. You don't get to just ignore it just because it's easier for you to do. Like, that's not using your privilege, being Black. It's not, no, you're going to have to suck it up and be with the ride for us.
And if someone sends me another or posts another Candace Owen, oh, here's another perspective. I'm gonna snap all of the pieces of Samuel L. Jackson's character out of Django Unchained, and I'm gonna be like, here's another perspective. Because she don't speak for me.
Yes. No, I saw on Instagram, there was a lovely lady who was like, the whole Jesus died for us, so all lives matter type thing. And she finally had her aha moment of, yes, Lord. And she finally had her aha moment of, you know, these parties aren't for me and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, really now? Where did you come up with that from? Because she used to be Republican, and then Candace Owens did all that. And she finally saw the light that all these other Republican, white Republicans, just really weren't here for her. And I'm just like, oh, you poor little Tink Tink. Like, you poor thing. How much you feel? I don't care. Like, good. Like, I won't sell myself angry, but I at a certain point, my cares and my fucks be gone. When, you know, you're just blinded by Jesus, or you're just blinded by whatever pantheon that you decide to align yourself with, and you think that the color of the skin still doesn't matter. Like, you know, if you're saying like, oh, I believe in a Black Jesus, but your Black Jesus, you know, oh, he loved everyone and he didn't flip over tables in the marketplace. It wasn't taking the whips and beating people because they disrespected his father's house. At what point do we say you're disrespecting our house and we clean house? Like, if that's what you believe in, at what point are you going to pick up the whip and start getting to business?
You know what? I'm going to take that. I'm going to be like, hey, a person of color died for your sins. Next time a Christian comes at me, I'm going to be like, hey, a person of color died for your sins. I'm going to need you to pay what you owe.
Oh, I need to see that screenshot because they're going to sit there. Block. Like, no, don't block me. I want to hear this conversation. Like, let me see the thought process of how you're going to excuse the fact that it said a man of wool in the skin of bronze, and he whipped and beat people who disrespected his father's house, and said, how dare you do this to my people and to my space? And then we're supposed to stay on our knees and pray?
I don't understand how they do not, people who say things like that, and are, you know, trying to tell people how they should be protesting and how angry they should be. How do they not see that there never comes a change with anything in this life unless you stand up and you fight? Because if you don't fight, they don't listen. You can talk all day, but they're not going to listen. The only reason they listen now is because shit got set on fire. Shit's getting, you know, destroyed. People are in an uprising. Uprisings are what change bring about positive change. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I don't know if y'all saw that post somebody had made. I don't remember if it was via Facebook or whether it was Instagram, but Martin Luther King's son was, you know, made a post. You saw that, right? And these men white explaining to him what his father meant. That was his father. Well, how are you going to try and tell Martin Luther King's son what his father meant? I'm pretty sure he knew what his father meant. And
but there's so many that do that, and it's like, bruh, I mean, why are you cherry picking? Why?
Right, like I don't understand that. And I'm pretty sure that he, you know, I mean, come on, you need revolution in order to fix people's backwards ideas of how things are supposed to be. And without that, there will never come change. You know, more people need
to be
out.
They're the bad guy.
Right.
They're the bad guy. And they don't want to be the bad guy. They want to go back to being either the NPC, you know, that says the same thing over and over again and you can ignore, or they have to admit that they're the bad guy and they don't want to be the bad guy. Well, I don't care. You're the bad guy.
Right.
And they hem, they haul, they retreat to their fortress of echotude to hear people say that they're not the bad guy, and then they leave that and they say that they're the bad guy. Now, I've heard arguments. It's like, well, we need to, you know, help these, or not even help, but, you know, how are these people going to change their minds? The people who are willing to change their minds are have done so or are doing so. But there are always going to be statistically people who are not going to change. And those people do it to themselves. They do it to themselves. French Revolution, we're not even over here rolling with guillotines. So you're getting off easy. You're getting off light. And by the way, you celebrated the French Rebellion. You celebrated a bunch of white people getting treated poorly and rebelling against some other white people. Well, you have to do the same thing for us.
But that's the difference. It was white people against white people, so they excused it. But now, because you have people of color, because at the end of the day, it's white people against white people, so it's okay. Like, didn't the French just have a revolution like a couple of years ago, and they outed their entire government? They had a whole coup d'etat, and the whole France united against it. But if we decide to have a coup d'etat because of the fact that it's too many people of color, it's too many brown, there's too many lights, there's too many biracials who don't accept the fact that they're biracial. So therefore, it's like if you have too many people that's not united, you're never going to have that system. The whole thing with the Civil War is that everybody finally had a point that they could unite on. My husband, he was talking about, he was worried about there being another Civil War. And I was like, there's no, you don't have to worry about it because the United States as a whole can't even get rid of the Confederate flag. When the Nazi Germany got rid of Nazism, they got rid of everything. They completely wiped it out of their history. They put it in the history books and they accepted that this is no longer a thing. Black people, the people of America have yet to accept that racism is a thing. Slavery was a thing and it affected. Jim Crow was a thing that affected. That there is generational gaps that no matter how long it takes, it will take at least a minimum of what? 3 generations or roughly 150 years before a singular black person can catch up to a singular poor white person. And you're going to tell me that we're supposed to have another Civil War? We're not. It's not going to happen. So to say, oh, well, these white people, they supported it. Of course, they saw their own. They were like, yeah, this is American history. And now the French are doing the same. But if the black people said the same thing, they'd be like, oh, no, you're supposed to be passive about it. Or, you know, it's not a thing anymore. We can't compare black people to me as America cannot compare anything that happened in white European history and try to copy the same because white people as a whole, have already made it known that we can't do the same thing as them. I mean, this is why we have so many murders. We can't do the same thing as white people because they don't see us as people. Like, that's the fundamental issue here, is that they don't see us as white people, as people. So if we try to do the same thing a white person does, as in have a revolution, as having protests, as in speaking out against, why are you so angry?
Perfect example in Canada. On what you're saying, perfect example in Canada, white people will sit there and criticize what's happening in the States. White Canadian people will criticize what's happening in the States and the way that people are protesting and, you know, riots and whatever else. But they'll go burn down a whole city because the hockey team lost. And that is a fact. They're upturning cars, setting cars on fire, tearing up an entire city over a hockey game. And that's okay because it's white people. But you get an actual issue that means something that's actually important that is, you know, and then it's not acceptable because it's black people.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to speak to what was talked about around other black people really struggling, well, some really struggling with how to protest or, you know, just the judgments around that. And, you know, that has been one thing over the years that's really kind of been hard for me. I'll put it that way. And, you know, I've really been working on myself and coming to understand the way that trauma and transgenerational trauma sets in. And, you know, the way that racial socialization happens and, you know, like with anyone who endures trauma, you know, what begins to be triggering because they feel unsafe, because they can't control it, because they can't keep, right? So I've been really working with myself to try and see that as it's happening, because I think it's one of the things that we as a whole community don't talk about at all. And as a Black community, are really working to understand is how trauma is has not only impacted us over the years, how it's been passed down over the years, but how it plays a part in our ability to even conceptualize our own liberation. And that, and I know I struggle, I've struggled with that and continue to try to unpack that for myself. And as a whole community, you know, I just think that that is not, we're slowly getting to the point of having those conversations, but we haven't really been able to. So anyway, I just wanted to say that because I too have seen over, you know, not just this time, but, you know, the last really publicized uprising around, you know, Ferguson and, you know, just like the same kind of narrative that narratives that come out of the Black community even. And, you know, I've had to really switch my own kind of engagement with it and be like, so, yeah, it's scary. Yeah, it feels, you know, disruptive in a way that we can't manage and keep our family safe. And we're afraid of what's going to happen and how we're going to be treated as a result. Mm-hmm, that's real. And we still got to do it. Right. And this is why. And we got it right. Like, so anyway, just really wanting to jump on that conversation because I, too, have run across that. And it's hard. It's been hard for me. Let me put it that way. It's been hard for me to engage in that conversation with other Black people.
Well,
I don't think
I'm so sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say it's been a long conversation and you guys have done a lot of work this morning and I cannot thank you enough for being here and for speaking up and being a part of this conversation. Both Lilith and Rebecca had to leave because, again, long conversation. We planned for an hour. We are going way, way, way over that. And I will sit here as long as you guys want to sit here. But I wanted to ask, you know, there are a lot of places that people draw hope from, that people are drawing self-care from right now. As leaders in your own communities, what is giving you hope, if there is any hope that you can find? If the answer to that is fuck hope, I have no hope. the world is a dumpster fire and we're all burning down and that's fine. I've been in those places and I can respect that. But if there is a place for hope for you, what is that? And what are you doing for self-care?
I try to stay off Facebook because literally it stresses me out. I am fighting with people every day trying to make them understand people that I think should be rational and have more sense than they do. And it's very futile. And there are days where I am just so tired. I don't even know what I'm just so tired. But it's my duty as a person of color to speak my mind, have a voice, and try my best to put out as much advocating information as I can and to correct people who are completely off base. I can't let it go. I have a big mouth. I can't let it go. I try not to look. Unfortunately, I always get dragged in and you know, I have to say something. I can't be complacent like that. My sign at the rally yesterday said silence is betrayal because I fully believe that. I fully believe if you don't speak up, if you don't have a voice, then you're being complacent and you're no better than the people oppressing, no matter what the cause is. If it's something you believe in and it's something that's wrong, you need to stand up for it and you need to say something. And that just is what it is. So self-care, I take a Facebook break. I take an Instagram break.
I am definitely taking time off from work. I am notoriously bad at taking time off from work. And, you know, even my even our director was like, Amanda, take a break. And I'm like, okay, fine. I am knitting for self-care, trying to exercise, which is a huge deal if anyone knows me. You know, so I'm trying to take better care of myself and show appreciation for what I do have. with the life that I lead, because I've certainly been blessed with my fair amount of privilege. But I get out there and I find some way to fight every day. There's protests in this area that I will be attending when on Facebook. I mean, I combat people if they're in my social circle. If they're not, I block those. You know, I'm not. You know what? You haven't earned my engagement. Now, I do have to engage with people who have influence, power, leadership, and authority in this system, and I'm not afraid to do so. I do try to reach out to government officials. We'll see where that goes, because, I mean, that's a whole mess. But what gives me hope right now is that I do believe the arc of history does tend towards justice. I do believe that people are mediocre. Mm. So we'll fight this battle again. It may be 100 years, 200 years, but there's the mix between good, neutral, and bad is such that we're not going to, this is just another moment, but it's also a movement. And so I'm going to be a part of it. I'm going to be pushing that arc of justice forward in this moment so that when my time is done, I can say that I contributed to the right thing. And that's what's important to me.
The way I deal with this, I've gotten into doing my nails. So pretty. Gel nails, crystals, putting crystals on it. The way I contribute is I do self-care is since I teach, I'm teaching my children. I'm putting Black everything first. We're doing African-American lit. We're doing African-American history. I'm learning along with her because I went to a majority white school. So I don't know half the things that she'll learn now that I had to learn at, you know, twice her age. I am a participant in a self-care by diving even more into manga and anime and considering learning Japanese just because they haven't released some things or they dropped the translation, so I want to learn it so I can read the wrongs. I think I've curated my Facebook and Instagram to a point where I don't see a lot of things that other people see, and I'm going to leave it just like that. I'm very specific about the people I add on my Facebook. I'm very specific about the people I let follow me back on my Instagram. So therefore, if I see that the first thing you say is I'm a believer before you say Black, you're probably not the person I need to have on my Instagram or anything else, because you're not going to contribute to my, you're not going to feed me the way I need to be fed in my circle. So I I'm very specific because I refuse to deal with that. And to, if social media, because I'm very much an introvert, social media is my getaway point. I refuse for social media to take it away from me either. So I will block, I will unfollow, I will delete whatever I need to, so that way when I want to deal with people, I can deal with the people I want to deal with. So I never have to, I refuse for social media to ever dictate and make me angry enough to the point where I need to take a social media break. So if I take a social media break, it's because I'm on vacation to somebody's island country and my husband's like, just wait for a huge photo dump versus, you know, being on there while I'm there, because I refuse. Like,
That's a really good question. I'm reading, so, which is funny because, I've been reading a lot lately for, you know, for many reasons, but, I had just started to read The Hunger Games, and then I'm like, well, damn it. Okay, so anyway, but I'm really enjoying it, and so I'm reading every day, which is really great, and that kind of helps me to disconnect a bit. I've been finding some hope in, interestingly enough, in a Clinicians of Color group that I'm lucky enough to be one of the co-moderators of, and it's just nice to, because all the other clinician groups that I'm a part of, are a hot ass mess. So, you know, like they just can't even, you know, there's just a whole segment of the population that cannot see what's happening as traumatic. And which blows my mind. But I can go into this clinician of color group and see people having real conversation about the needs of Black people and other people of color. And that gives me hope, right? And then I think the other thing that gives me hope right now is really my kids, right? And, you know, my daughter a couple days ago sends me a TikTok about, you know, a TikTok, like, you know, there you go. And so she sends me a TikTok about, you know, this whole scene around the guy having lunch and the whole Black, you know, All Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter thing. And it's a whole scene around that to try and explain what it means. And my kid's 11. And she's like, you know, like, Mom, look at this video. I think you would like this one. And, you know, she's like, really, you know, and my 18-year-old, I mean, so that I got an email from my 18-year-old, you know, sign this petition around George Floyd. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, they're on their phones and doing their social media thing, and they're thinking about what they need to think about right now. And that gives me hope, because if at their age they can start unpacking some of this stuff, then maybe that by the time they're my age, they will have some really clear avenues on how to keep themselves, how to be liberated, how to work towards liberation. And so anyway, that gives me hope. You know, even if I have to watch TikTok.
I feel like Crystal's kids and Tiffany's kids would get along really, really well.
That's awesome.
Yes, they would. Because currently they're watching TikTok videos on the TV. So yes.
Nice.
Well, we are coming up on about 2 hours now of this conversation. So I will go ahead and let you guys get back to your Sunday. I'm so incredibly grateful and humbled and privileged and honored that you all, one, took the time out to say yes, to raise your hand, to say, I am happy to have this conversation. I hope that you felt this was useful. I hope that you felt that this was helpful in some kind of way. I'm happy to do it again. If you guys say, hey, I've got some thoughts, any of you are welcome back anytime whatsoever. I will make sure that all of your information are in the show notes so that people can find more about you, your businesses, so that they can spend their coins with you, so that they can support you or learn more from you if you are one of the people that's doing public education or public advocacy in some kind of way. I don't want this conversation to start and end here. Thank you guys so much. Before we wrap up, is there any last words that anybody has?
Don't be scared to buy Black. Just because you don't see a white person in the store doesn't mean that they don't want your coin. There is plenty of times that Black people are like, you know, we can't survive. We're not making the coin. It's because white people are too scared to spend the money. Spend the money. If you want something, spend it. We'd rather it be, unless it's specifically for a Black person, otherwise sponsor the Black business. Either way, go, open your wallet, spread the word, you know, do your part.
I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, you know, first of all, a lot of gratitude for being here this morning, despite the time. And because I love seeing the faces of people and talking to people and hearing their wisdom and knowing that we're in this struggle together, that these are fellow Black people that, you know, I wouldn't get to meet otherwise. So I'm really grateful for that. And I feel like I'm walking away with some good words and wisdom that I get to ponder over myself. And I appreciate that. And the last thing that I would leave is everybody has to do the work. Like, there's no easy out. There's no, equation of just do this one thing and then we can move, you know, forward and change the world. No, it's going to be painful, hard. work, and everybody has to do it. Black people have been doing it for a very long time. It's white people's turn, right? Like, do the work, educate yourself, be present, ask how you can help. Stop trying to take over shit. Just, you know, ask how you can help and how you can be present for Black people that are in this struggle, and do the work. And I think if everybody does the work, we might see something shift.
I got a quote here from Pope Paul VI, and it says, if you want peace, you work for justice. And so for all of the people who are seeing the turmoil, who are seeing the pain, they're feeling it, it's making them uncomfortable, anxious, angry, terrified, work for justice. That's how you're. That's how we're going to get over this. Know who you're voting for. Know where your company stands. Know the Black businesses around you. Know the Black people around you, and stand in solidarity. Stand up to other human beings. It doesn't matter what the color of their skin may be, but just know that if you're white, you have an opportunity, a privilege, a power and influence to make other white people understand that they too need to hear Black voices and to expose themselves consistently to Black faces. We're here. We got brought here. We're a part of the American fabric, the foundation of it. And it is owed to us that the white people of this country understand and appreciate who we are.
Well, I'd just like to say it was wonderful meeting all of you. I love that we all have kind of different perspectives on things in certain regards, yet we're all still very much in agreeance with a lot of the points, which is absolutely amazing. Just know you have a Canadian sister who stands in solidarity with you. And I will forever, as long as I can, fight for what is right against anybody. I don't care who it is. And my last words would be, don't be complacent. Don't be silent for anyone who's listening to this. You have a voice. Use it. Use it in the most positive way. You have resources. Help your fellow human beings out, you know. And thanks so much for having me on the show. It was awesome.
I'm going to make my husband listen to this so that I can just prove to him that I can shut up for 2 hours. Oh, goodness. Thank you all so incredibly much for being here. The conversation doesn't end here. Folks, please go to incitingariot.com. Look up all of the wonderful voices from today. Buy their books. Buy their wares. Support their causes. Go to the places where they are pointing to and support those causes. Continue this conversation. Continue your own learning, your own unlearning, your own unpacking. I know that my own doesn't ever end. I know, you know, my husband's a person of color. He's a gay Mexican immigrant in Trump's America, which is just a interesting thing to be right now. And the world he walks in and the world I walk in are two very, very different worlds. And my own unpacking and unlearning has been a long, long journey. So it doesn't end here. It doesn't end with a podcast. It doesn't end with a black square on Instagram. There is a lot of work to do. But folks like you out there advocating and speaking up give me so much hope and give me so much joy that this process might burn some stuff down, but it might regrow some stuff that needs to regrow. Folks, that's going to do it here for us. Episode 145, Inciting a Black Lives Matter Riot. Once again, to Kat, Crystal, Lilith, Tiffany, Rebecca, Phoenix, and Amanda. The emotional labor, the work that you guys did here on this conversation is brilliant. It's beautiful. It's bold. And I cannot thank you enough. So thank you. Thank you guys so much. If you are a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/incitingprojects, you will notice that the full unedited audio and video are available to you, and they were not charged for you this month. So these were free to Patreon supporters. And if you donate at the $1 level and you're used to only getting that unedited audio, you'll notice you also have access to the unedited video as well for this episode, because this was an important conversation and one that I didn't want to limit behind a paywall or a charge wall or something like that. So if you're already a Patreon supporter, you didn't get any additional charges for this episode. Also, I just wanted to note that the donations of this month's Patreon are going to go to Mutual Aid Networks. I know that a lot of bail funds are reporting really high donation numbers, and they're saying they don't really need any more right now. So they'll be donated to Mutual Aid Networks to try to assist folks that are struggling. I know that the trans activist India Moore is putting together some brilliant aid networks to specifically target the needs of brown and black people, specifically black trans women right now, who are the most vulnerable. So this month's money is going to go there. Thank you guys so much for giving and supporting independent pagan media. I am very blessed and privileged right now to still have a job and to be able to work from home. So it didn't feel any kind of right to take this money and put it towards the podcast whenever so many other people are in such need. That being said, if you would like to communicate with the show, you can email me firelight, firelyte, at incitingariot.com. You can also tweet me at Inciting a Riot. I'm on Facebook. I'm Firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E. You can also find the Inciting a Riot Facebook page, facebook.com/incitingariotpodcast. Links to everything else are going to be in the show notes at incitingariot.com, including ways to interact with the seven brave, beautiful, wonderful people who were here today. Please, 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 as Tiffany said, you know, give them your coins. Please don't just let your advocacy be verbal. Don't just let it be a black square. If you're privileged and have money, if you have time, if you have space, if you have resources, give those, because now is the time to give. And don't stop giving once the meme ends, once the Instagram challenge notion of it all dies down. Don't let this die down. This is not a time to, this is not a cause to let go by the wayside. So I'm going to leave you, but as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.